What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardawar. This week, I'm joined by Senior Reporter Igor Bonifacic. Hey, Igor, how's it going?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining. And this is a special one because it is countdown to the iPhone event. We heard that Apple has scheduled the iPhone event for September 9th. That's when we're expecting the whole iPhone 17. And to celebrate that or to prepare for that, we're bringing on Mr. Mark Gurman from Bloomberg, the guy who reports on a lot of the iPhone rumors, to chat. Stay tuned for that. And I think we'll have a good chat about AI and a few other things too, but a lot of iPhone rumors, a lot of Apple rumors. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. We'd love your questions, and they may get read on the show. They may go into our Ask Engadget section on the site too. So, you know, send us a note, podcastengadget.com. So let's get to those iPhone 17 rumors. Joining us to talk about all this is Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, the guy who breaks most of these rumors. Hello, Mark. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for joining
again.
What's
going on?
It's nothing much. You know what? I feel like we're just doing this every year now, right? It's been a couple of years where you've come on to help us break some of these iPhone rumors. Apple announced that there is going to be an event September 9th. That's where we're expecting the iPhone 17. We've talked about a couple of things, Mark. Like throughout the last year, we've talked about the rumors of the iPhone 17 Air, the super thin iPhone. Is that the big new thing everyone's expecting this year?
Well, it depends who you ask, right? Like in terms of marketability and what they're going to build the event around and what the excitement in the hands-on area, what people are going to want to grab in the Apple stores when they go in for the first time to look at the new devices. Yeah, it'll be the iPhone 17 Air. In terms of what people are actually going to buy, I don't necessarily think it will be the iPhone 17 Air. I think consumers are smart enough to know what they value in these types of devices at this point. And in my mind, the two most important things in 2025 for a smartphone buyer are battery life and camera performance. And the 17 Air is going to lag in both. There's a lot of similarities in the 17 Air with the original MacBook Air. If you remember, that was a very compromised machine. It was thinner, it was lighter, yeah. More portable, more exciting, more marketable than any of the other MacBooks at the time. But battery life was subpar. I believe it was, sub 5 hours at that point. And the, the bigger thing there is the performance, right, was also very subpar. Now, these days, because of the processors, I don't see the performance being much reduced compared to the Pro models. It'll certainly be on par with the performance in the baseline iPhone 17, which is pretty good. But if you think about the performance people care most about, it's the camera technology. And at least for these first couple generations of the 17 Air, or the Air line, I should say, thin and light and compromised performance, just like a MacBook Air back in the day. But then you saw what happened over the arc of time. You get a MacBook Air today, or you get an iPad Air today, those are not necessarily devices where you're compromising. You're getting the thin and light form factor with pretty good performance. Maybe you're compromising a bit compared to a pro-level machine, but you're not compromising in battery life, right? The battery life on the MacBook Air today is insane. You're not compromising necessarily on performance on the iPad Air either. It's just a different variation of the different products in the line. So initially, it'll be a compromising machine, but it's going to show you where the iPhone line is going. And so eventually, we are going to get iPhone Airs that don't compromise as much as this initial version. So to me, this is more exciting about the arc of time rather than what's actually coming out in a couple weeks from now.
Yeah, I kind of feel that. Like the more I've been thinking about this, rumors are it's going to have a single camera on the back, really low battery life. People were asking in the chat, like, when can we expect another iPhone mini? I don't think we will, because the battery life was so terrible that everybody who's bought that thing, I've only seen complaints. I kind of feel like that's going to happen here again, like just predicting how people react to the iPhone Air personally. Do you think that's the case, Mark?
I think that it's I don't know, a hip phone. It's
yeah,
a cool...
Yeah.
A cool marketable thing, the kids will love it, but it's not effective for the mass consumer, right? Maybe it's cool for someone who goes to school and the phone is in their backpack or some such, and they don't need to pull the phone out until after 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and they you know, just need it for the second half of the day. But to power through a day with everything you need to do, you're not going to be able to do that without some real efficiency gains by adding a battery pack or plugging in throughout the day, right? I'm not saying this phone is going to die out in 4 hours. What I'm saying is the battery life is going to be subpar compared to a base level 17 or a pro model. Because to tell you what, the battery life on these pro models are pretty good. I'm not saying Samsung is the benchmark for Apple or us to base the performance of the still yet to be announced 17 Air on, but all the data points that I've seen is that the Samsung S25 Edge, which is on the market right now and the closest kin to what you would see from a 17 Air, I'm not seeing consumers bend over backwards to buy that thing. It's exciting to hold. It's great to use in the store. You pick it up and, you know, to the point that Apple's trying to make on its invite, it's jaw-dropping when you hold it and use it for the first time. But it feels like the type of device you might get tired of because of the battery life limitations and one single camera on the back compared to the three lenses you're getting on the back of a pro phone at this point. And the other thing you have to take into account, it's not like you're going to get a major savings price point wise. Usually when you have a compromised device in general in the consumer gadget world, you also have a compromised price point where it's a lower price point. The MacBook Air was a bit different when it launched in 08. The original version, the price point was on par or even more expensive than a MacBook base level and pretty close to a MacBook Pro. These iPhone Air price points, my belief is that it's going to be around $900. And so you're going to be able to get a pro phone for $100, $150, $200 more. And the amount of performance difference you're going to get in that is going to be tremendous. And if you think about from a thin and light standpoint, yeah, it's going to be so much thinner and lighter than the pros, but it's not like the pros or these bricks or anything like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. I honestly kind of appreciate the heft of the pros, and I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be worth that just to, you know, losing features just to get a thin phone. Igor, any questions from you?
Yeah, I guess I wonder, like, what are the generational technologies that Apple is expecting to implement, like, year over year here? Because with the MacBook Air, you know, SSDs was a huge jump that enabled that storyline. But I guess here, like, cameras are probably not going to get thinner unless there's, like, a real, like, sea change in battery technology. Battery life is not going to get better. And I imagine there is some throttling that they have to do because of how small the phone is to make it performant, right?
I think over time, you'll see a few things. One, the chips are going to get more efficient, right? And so if the chips get more efficient, the battery life is going to improve. Battery chemistry will improve. So you're going to be able to get a better battery life within that thin form factor. The other thing is the modems are going to get more efficient. So the 17 Air is going to use the same modem as the 16E. It has a pretty efficient modem compared to what you're seeing on the Qualcomm side. The next generation modems are going to be even more efficient. And then I would anticipate eventually them being able to get multiple cameras into the device. You know, the ultimate goal, and they will get there, it is just a matter of time and potentially a lot of time, get all the same functionality and features that you can in the Pro model in something the size of an Air model. And they will get there. They will get there. I mean, you've seen it in the other product lines as well. Like the difference in size between a MacBook Air and a MacBook Pro, it's quite minimal. On the iPad side, you know, the iPad Pro is thinner than the iPad Air. So you are going to see the arc of time with technology do its thing. I highly anticipate that.
Speaking of the arc of time, there's been a lot of talk that this Air will kind of prove that Apple can make a super thin single plane. It's not hard to like look forward and be like, oh, a foldable iPhone is kind of the same thing. They'll have to be working probably at that same level of thinness or something. Do you think like the experience here with the Air could help them build the supposed foldable iPhone?
Well, you know, internally, the iPhone Air is basically them working towards a redesigned Pro model in a few years from now and that foldable phone. It's using the foldable phone. When you open up the Air and you open up the foldable next fall, you're going to see a lot of overlap in components from the batteries, from the modem, from some of the camera changes, in the internal, like physical engineered internal architecture that they're using, there's going to be a lot of overlap between the two. So the Air is a stepping stone towards that foldable. And speaking of the foldable, we're not going to hear anything from Apple about that next month, obviously. But that, I think, is the big one that I'm personally looking forward to. I'm sure you guys have tested the new Samsung Folds relentlessly. I think it's a great product. I just want it with iOS. And so we'll get that next year.
That is kind of the thing holding me back from any foldable at this point, is that I fear I'm too locked in. Apple did too good of a job there. Do we expect anything major on the iPhone 17 or Pro or Pro Max at this point? Like, what else can Apple do other than, you know, switch up where the cameras are and make things faster and more efficient?
On the 17 regular, the big change is that they're going to follow what they did last year, which was they moved the base size of the Pro, regular Pro, from 6.1 inch diag to 6.3. And so they'll do that. They'll go up to 120 hertz. So you'll get the ProMotion on a base level phone for the first time. Other than that, it's the processor spec bump. The Pro and Pro Max, internally, it's considered a new ID, so a new industrial design. So you're going to get that redesign back. So the front going to look the same. The back will be redesigned. You'll get that new camera architecture for the improved optical zoom, that new layout, a couple new colors. Obviously, they're going to tout significant gains on battery and performance with the new chip. But other than that, it's going to be quite minimal, quite iterative. Not as iterative externally as you saw from Pixel 9 to Pixel 10, but it is not some sort of going from the iPhone 7 to the iPhone 10. We'll get that iPhone 20 leap in a couple years from now. The other things I'm expecting at this launch next week would be the AirPods Pro update I wrote about a couple weeks ago, as well as updated Apple Watches. And for the first time in a few years, they're going to update all of the models. I expect the changes to not be overhauls, mm-hmm. I'll say.
Gotcha. I did see some reporting that Apple could be potentially starting to split up iPhone events, like having one in the spring, one in the fall, and kind of stagger when we'll see certain models. Have you heard much about that?
Yes. The one issue they're going to run into is that at some point, it's going to be hard to differentiate the E models with the base models, which they're sort of conjoining together in the spring. One reason they're doing this is that they have so many models. Another reason they're doing this is to have more marketability throughout the course of the year. In terms, you know, Apple is a company that's very run by marketing, PR, and obviously the finance team. And what the finance team has seen, and we've all seen this covering their earnings reports, is that a lot of their revenue is very backloaded. And that's not necessarily a great thing for a consistent business. And so moving some of the iPhone models to the spring and building up hype around the spring allows you to get better return and better consistently throughout the course of the year. And so that's, you know, some of the factors going into that. But if you look at a base level iPhone and you look at an E iPhone, very similar functionality at this point. I mean, you're split off by basically one camera. The processing power is essentially the same.
Yeah. MagSafe.
The battery life is very similar. So
MagSafe is the thing we were sad to see lost on the E, because we all love MagSafe over here.
MagSafe is missing. Yes, that's right. But the problem is that the price point situation that you have, if you look at the price point of a base iPhone in an E model right now, it's $150 delta. My belief is that the the $600 price, can't believe the 16 is $600.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, that felt like tariff-related pricing to mm-hmm. some extent. And so right now, it may be a $100 difference between a base phone and a 16e, which is, I guess, a sub-base phone. There's a universe in which the price delta is $300 more expansive, $400 even. That makes the 16e more relevant, or the E-line more relevant, while also keeping that base model. So it could really go either way.
Awesome. Anything else from you, Igor, while we've got Mark here?
Yeah, I guess if we could just circle back to the foldables, is the feeling at Apple that the display technology has come far enough? And I guess a corollary to that is like, is the feeling that they really need to release a foldable, that there's going to be significant enough differentiation between their model and the competition?
I don't think the Apple foldable is going to have any semblance of differentiation, personally, other than the obviously their internal components, whether that's their modem, their chips, and obviously their software. My belief and my understanding talking to all these OEMs is that next year is the year of no crease. And so I would anticipate that next fall, let me take a step back, not no crease, reduced crease. Mm-hmm. I would anticipate the Pixel Fold 4, the Samsung Fold 8, and the Apple Fold 1. I'm not saying that's the name. I'm just saying that for the sake of the conversation. They will all be using pretty much the same lesser crease technology. They've all figured this out. Mm-hmm. I mean, Samsung is providing the industry, right? And so they go with Samsung. Yeah.
I feel like maybe that was the thing Apple's waiting for. Like, we're not going to do anything until we can get that crease knocked down. Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you online these days to follow all your rumors and everything?
Yeah, no, thank you for having me both. I really appreciate it. You know, I love Engadget. Mark Gurman on Twitter, on Threads. I guess there's Mastodon and Blue Sky. Just my first name, last name, pretty much everywhere.
Awesome. Your newsletter, right? People should subscribe.
Yeah, most importantly. Yeah, Bloomberg.com/PowerOn. Subscribe there, please. Looking forward to the event. Looking forward to our coverage. And, of course, seeing Engadget's coverage as well. So really appreciate it.
So, Igor, I think Mark laid out a really just like a very straightforward look at like what we can expect. And honestly, it doesn't seem like the iPhone Air is going to be that compelling. And it feels like he's not super enthusiastic about it. Other rumors I've seen don't really point to much other than it being super thin. Like, is that, do you think that's going to be the vibe with this thing? Like, all looks, but all sacrifice too?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm very interested to see how, whether this, the vision he laid out, you know, year over year changes really does happen. I'm somewhat more skeptical, if only because I think there were much more obvious technologies that, you know, I think made the evolution of the MacBook Air possible, where I think here it's a bit harder. I'm sure, you know, like Apple is probably investing all the R&D into this. But I'm just not well read enough on this to know like the exact breakthroughs that they're kind of banking on to make a really compelling iPhone Air possible.
I think the key breakthrough is just like thin. That's all they're thinking about. Like, I'm thinking about when I first saw those new iPad Pros that they were selling that were just supposed to be super thin. I was like, okay, we read about it. We wrote about it. It's like, oh, that's interesting. It seems kind of silly that that's all they're banking on. Then I saw one of them in person when I was covering WWDC. I was like, what the hell? This thing looks like paper. It looks like it is. I've seen magazines that are far thicker, you know, than what those iPad Pros look like. So I do feel like there is some just like visually compelling and usability compelling thing towards thinness, even though you're going to lose battery life. I don't think this first model of the iPhone Air is going to be a must have for a lot of people, but it does get Apple in the space of like, okay, what can we do with a super thin phone? What do we leave behind? What do we choose not to leave behind next time? Right? Like, how do we make battery life work better for something this thin? They're going to hit like the limits of physics here, you know, because you can't go, you got to have a decent battery. Like, that's it. That's, we expect practically all day battery life. So if this thing comes out and it has terrible battery life, like the minis, I don't think that's going to be good for them or the public response to it. It just seems like thinness is the only thing that they're selling here. What Mark pointed out is that he doesn't think like hardware wise, the iPhone Fold, when it comes next year, which is what the rumor is, he doesn't think like it's going to be fundamentally that different than what we're seeing from, you know, from Google and from Samsung. But I think there's a key difference. And this is the thing that Apple does. Apple knows how to make iPad OS, right? Like, Apple knows how to make a good tablet operating system, and Google does not. Google has fully given up on tablets. They've like started and stopped their whole tablet stat. Yeah. Several times. Like it's really just Samsung. Samsung's out there making premium Android tablets. I don't think anybody's buying them. The most popular Android tablet are the Kindle Fires because Amazon has stripped them down to be super cheap and put their own interface on them and has like de-Googled it, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think more importantly than that is I think Apple can rally developers and force buy-in on their part to make really compelling iPhone foldable apps, right? Because I think really that is, you know, yeah, the Google apps and the Samsung apps work well, but once you get into the third-party apps, it falls apart a bit. Some are better than others, obviously, but I think just the buy-in that Apple is able to command, I think that is going to be probably the biggest differentiating factor. And, you know, to your point, like, in a way, Apple has already been doing this work for a decade plus with iPadOS. So the jump is...
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
much less substantial, right?
They've done the work. They've done the people, developers already have iPhone apps. They already have iPad apps. Like, maybe they will have a way to like, a way to like transition between them when you open up an iPhone fold instantly. That could be something. But that's kind of the thing. Like, nobody else has figured out tablets. I don't want to be an Apple stan. Like, I go to like where the best solution is typically. And it's just that I've been here long enough to see the entire rise of tablets. I've lived through Nexus tablets. I've lived through every iteration of Samsung tablet. I'm like, there was some cool stuff there, but Google didn't give a shit. Like, Google just didn't care. And this is one of the things that irks me. Like, Google will sometimes be like, oh, this is a really, here's some cool hardware. Here's a cool idea. Here's where we could take it. And they just like whiff every single time because I don't think they care enough. Like, they don't care about delivering a great product ultimately because of the way Google is set up. Like, Google is such a middle manager company. That's the thing. Like, if somebody will work on a project and then they get, you know, they get a raise or
promotion,
they go somewhere else. And then nobody is left like being like, this is my baby. I care a lot about Android tablet stuff. There were a handful of people like that early on in the Android era, especially around like the Nexus time, but they just really lack that. So anyway, that's kind of like why I think the iPhone fold. I'll probably write about this at some point because I feel like this is kind of the big thing. iPadOS is not perfect. It is not the best multitasking tablet OS out there, but it is ultimately the best option. You know, it's unfortunate. Like, for all its deficiencies, it is the best one so far, I guess. So yeah. Any other follow up thoughts, Igor, around the iPhone event?
Only that I imagine, you know, once we get this foldable iPhone, that Instagram will finally release an iPad app because they'll have no option but to, right? So this is what it's going to take, a foldable iPhone.
Yeah, when pigs fly, when iPhones fold, there will be an Instagram iPad app. Some quick thoughts going out here. We are expecting to see an Apple Watch 11 and Apple Watch Ultra 3 at the iPhone events as well. So, you know, the basic stuff. It will be interesting to see like what they do with the next AirPods Pro because those things have been so successful. I use them every day. I think I use them every hour. Like, I'm like attached to my AirPods because I'm always either listening to podcasts or jumping on calls or jumping on Zoom chats. Like, you need them. So I am interested to see like what they do there in terms of optimizing those things and making them sound better and more efficient or something. What would you want to see, Igor, from a new set of AirPod Pros? Where are they missing at this point?
You know, for me, the thing has always been the fit. Like, no matter which ear tips I try, I can't get a perfect seal, which really affects the sound quality. And, you know,
Have you tried the Comply foam tips?
I have. I just don't like the foam. I really prefer silicone.
You gotta pick a lane. Like, you want a perfect fit, then you have to have some foam in your ear, unfortunately. But yeah, you're right that the silicone stuff like has trouble. Like, I've had trouble getting them to fit too. Yeah.
I mean, beyond that, it's really like, I think from like a software and usability standpoint, forget the sound quality. I think the sound quality is good enough, but from a usability and functionality standpoint, they're just head and tails above the competition. It really, that's only because you know, Apple can do that integration with iOS. And it's like, I'm constantly just like amazed, you know, like how you can customize the thing, like the AirPods, to really just suit your needs, right? And it's just, they feel like such a great extension of the iPhone. I'm not saying anything new or revolutionary here, but really it is that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, what I would love, I need some magical features. Like, I need, like, when you drop your AirPods and they go exploding out to the other room, I need to hit a button and them to zip right back in. I don't care where they are. I need magnets to put them right back in there. You drop your, you know, you drop your AirPods through a sewer grate, which has happened to a lot of people. You look around New York, you'll see them everywhere. People need ways to retrieve those things. I guess we'll have to start adding cords to them. What would that look like? Earbuds with cords. Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, you know, the one thing I would love is if they made it much easier to replace the batteries through, like, you know, you, instead of just buying new ones, you know, if there was a way for the technicians to just replace the batteries, that'd be incredible. But obviously then probably it's not going to be as thin and light.
They're too small. Like, they're too small. And then you don't want, like, big chunky earbuds, like, the Microsoft Surface Buds, which were those big circles. I've seen some big ugly buds, like the early Sony earbuds were huge. But you could probably replace the batteries on those easily. Anyway, folks, we are going to be talking about iPhone rumors leading up to September 9th. We'll have a lot more coverage on the site. Let us know. Do you have any more questions? Drop us an email at podcastsandengadget.com. All right, let's move on to other news. And I guess something grim happened this week. The first known AI wrongful death lawsuit accused OpenAI of enabling a teen suicide. There's a big piece at the New York Times about this by Kashmir Hill. The title is "A Teen Was Suicidal. ChatGPT Was a Friend He Confided In." And basically that story breaks down how the parents of this child, who unfortunately committed suicide, the parents found, like, extended chat histories with ChatGPT about how he could plan this, judging his, like, is this a good noose? I think, like, it was even, like, giving him them tips on this. Just a really sad, disturbing thing. There are guardrails to prevent this. Like, as a user is starting to talk about disturbing things, like, it is supposed to suggest help, but this kid apparently just said, like, hey, I'm writing a book about this. Like, I'm doing research. This isn't real. And it kept the conversation going. Igor, you're doing AI reporting for us now. Like, how significant is this, you think?
It's hard to say, right? Because I think, you know, certainly OpenAI has enough money, resources to potentially make this go away. But I think it's it highlights something that we probably all intuitively feel, which is these systems aren't intelligent, right? Like, a truly intelligent system would know not to guide a user away from this path of thinking, right? Or get them help, right? And I think the fact that it was able, for lack of a better word, to be gamed in this way is just really disappointing and sad. And, you know, to OpenAI's credit, and what we should qualify here is that this was using GPT-4o, right? So the previous system, which is not even, you know, their most robust and advanced system at the time, right? And with GPT-5.0, they've introduced new safety features that are specifically targeted at situations like this, where you know, the system should be better at kind of differentiating why you're asking a certain set of questions. But ultimately, you know, like, underlying the problem of all of this is that these systems are so syncopactic, right? Like, they want to, for lack of a better word, like, please you and give you the answer that you want. And, you know, so that's what they're designed. That's where there's a huge flaw in their designs, right? And I think we're seeing a whole host of problems arise from this, where people, you know, there's just something bad that happens when you keep talking to, whether it's a person or an AI system, that just kind of reaffirms all your beliefs and kind of pushes you down a certain thought process.
It's disgusting. I mean, this kind of ties back to the thing we saw where people were like, oh, no, my AI girlfriend slash boyfriend is gone because GPT-5 is so different than 4. And, you know, it's gonna make people do crazy things. It's also going to lead to like severe emotional responses. I don't think we are not ready as a society for these things because we are so easily fooled. But it's in our nature. It's in our like programming, basically, to be fooled by things that pretend to be sentient to us. I don't know. Another reason I worry about this. Are you regularly using any AI like chatbot at this point, Igor? Not just for work stuff?
So in the process of relearning guitar after like a decade away, I will sometimes, what I find ChatGPT and Claude are really good is organizing their thoughts, much better than thoughts in quotations here, are much better at organizing it than say, like if you want to find the exact same answer online, you know, you might have to dig through Reddit and like judge what 12 different people are saying and they're all saying the different things. So I find that's where, and I think this is actually what most people use these chatbots for. I think 70% are using it just for search, right?
Right.
And so that's what I use it, but very infrequently.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm testing the new iOS. So like I occasionally ask Siri things and it'll be like, hey, do you want to ask ChatGPT this? Because I'm very stupid. And that's, I let it do that. And I hear what the response is. And sometimes it's useful, sometimes it's not. I have been using that like visual intelligence search button thing that popped up in the recent betas. And that is helpful sometimes. I'm like, what flower is this? And the basics theory search won't do it. I could like drop it into, you know, the Google image search thing and do that. But it's kind of helpful to just have like a button you press and be like, oh, identify this thing. That's kind of cool. I will still double check it later. But it's interesting. I can get some sort of immediate response. I cannot see having like a prolonged relationship with a chatbot, though, like a thing I talk to as a friend. I don't know. That is just still a little bit beyond me. Anyway, I think the story is very sad, but we are probably going to hear more things like this. And it's going to be interesting to see how OpenAI responds to the sort of like thing they owe their users, right? Like actual safety and something every major platform has faced. Like, I don't think Mark Zuckerberg handled the Myanmar genocide very well. You know, they have ignored a lot of things. And those were all horrific things that happened because of a technology platform. And we've just kind of memory holed a lot of this stuff. So we shall see. We'll be keeping an eye on the story and the follow-up to it. It's just beginning. You're also covering something, Igor, that was interesting. This dropped right after last week's episode. I think it was last Friday, but the U.S. government agreed to take an $8.9 billion stake in Intel, a 10% stake. The ultimate, like this, you know, this is actually money coming from the CHIPS Act. This is money that was going to go to Intel initially, but it's being positioned as the government buying 10% of Intel. This seems weird. I still don't know what to make of this. And this is also after the Trump administration, like Trump himself was like saying Intel CEO is a Chinese spy. And then he had to go meet with them and I don't know, Gladhand or something. What is going on here, Igor?
Yeah, it's certainly, I think, an unprecedented moment, right? Like looking back, like thinking back to it, right? Like I can only think of really one example of when something similar like this has happened. And that was, you know, following the 2008 recession when, you know, banks and car companies were bailed out. But the fact that this is already money that was earmarked for Intel, right? And money that was designed to, you know, kind of make U.S. semiconductor manufacturing more secure is just, it, and there hasn't been a lot of transparency about, you know, Lutnick initially said that these weren't voting shares, but they're common stocks, so they are voting shares. And the government has kind of like promised to vote with shareholders. And, you know, so I have some interviews lined up, but one thing I'm really interested in exploring is like, what are like the policy implications when, let's say, you're Qualcomm and, you know, potentially, you know, how is this not a conflict of interest if the Trump administration is making policy when it has a 10% stake in one of your competitors, right? You know, like I think there's a very good reason why in a capitalistic society, why ideally we don't want the government to have stakes and gum for these, right?
This is also literally the fear of like every conservative economist and anybody, you know, professing conservative philosophies, like, oh no, they're going to take over our companies. And okay, I don't understand what's happening now.
Quote unquote, yeah. Pick winners, right? Like,
yeah. Also funny, this money is coming from the CHIPS Act. The CHIPS Act is a Biden initiative. And as we've seen, like, the Trump administration has to basically either erase or like just stamp its own name on something coming from the Biden administration. So the EV tax credits, which I've written about, you know, they're ending at the end of September, but that's only because, basically only because they came from like Biden's plans, and we don't want anything good in the world. That's basically where we are right now. So what a sad state of affairs. We're going to be following the story. We're going to see if this means anything, like, for the other chip companies. And what are they, like, is everybody else going to have to go and beg? And I don't know. We don't know. Like, everything is in turmoil right now. What a fun time to be covering technology news and news in general. Anyway, anything else you want to mention, Igor? Anything else going on?
Just only in relation to OpenAI. So yesterday they published evaluative research that they did in cooperation with Anthropic, where it was really interesting because the two companies basically tested each other's systems to find safety flaws. And lo and behold, one of the issues that Anthropic discovered with ChatGPT was, you know, it tends to be an ass kisser. Right. And so if you have just a few moments, chat, I really recommend Anna, one of our news writers, did a great job writing up the news after my shift. So she did. Yeah, it's a really short article. So just read it. It's really interesting work. Yeah.
It is funny how GPT is so sycophantic and how that kind of relates to like all the stories we hear about Sam Altman, is that he is the kind of guy who will literally tell everybody what they want to hear. And that's kind of how he gets the ear of like, people who have money and people who have power, is that he's very good at telling people what they want. And was it modeled on him? I don't know. Anyway, folks, if you are interested in any of these AI stories, go check out the book we've recommended before, Empire of AI by Karen Howe. I'm trying to get her on at some point to talk about like everything she's covered when it comes to Altman and OpenAI in general. Let's move on to what we're working on. Igor, what's going on with you this week?
So I'm working on an interview with Proton. I had a really great chat with they're basically the head of their AI department, such that it is.
Proton is like the note-taking app, right?
Proton, so they're all about the privacy. So they have...
Oh, right. No, the VPN and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, so they have a chatbot called Lumo. Lumo's interesting because the company doesn't record any of your chats with it. And it's all built on open source models. And it was really interesting talking to this guy because he doesn't believe the current models will lead, that is large language learning models, will lead to AGI, right? So it was really interesting. I'm also working on a section on the government buying a 10% stake into Intel. Talking to some experts about that.
Cool. Very cool. As for me, it's been a whole bunch of things. I'm doing a lot of Windows 10 preparation right now for the end of Windows 10. So we'll do more stories around that. I'm working on a review of the Dell Premium 16, which is the XPS 16 follow-up. Also a review of the Xreal 1 Pro. And potentially some tiny desktops as well. We've seen a lot of small systems going for like $150. That are kind of interesting. Have you seen those, Igor?
I haven't, no.
There's some good stuff. A lot of them have Celeron processors. A lot of them have 16 gigabytes of RAM at $150 to $200. And that is just, it's surprising to me. So I want to call one of those in and we'll take a closer look at that. Any pop culture picks you want to shout out, Igor?
Yeah, right now, I don't know if this will still be the case once we publish this podcast, but right now Steam is having a sale on a game called Arco. It's 50% off for its first anniversary, and it's this really wonderful, hard to describe because it's like, the setting is like a Mesoamerican fantasy setting, which is really wonderful. Mm-hmm. It has really beautiful
pixels. I've seen that, yeah.
and a really innovative combat system. And I've just been loving it. So I got it for like $15 Canadian, which isn't real money. So it'd probably be even less with real money. And I just can't recommend it enough.
Very cool. Very cool. As for me, I've been kind of on a kick. I've been, I had to review the film Neja 2, the Chinese animated, action epic for my movie podcast. And because of that, I watched Neja 1 for the first time, because this thing is a phenomenon. Neja 2 is the highest grossing animated movie ever, apparently. It's been a huge thing. It's been re-released in the US. I'm assuming it's in Canada as well. By A24 with an English cast. And that's kind of interesting as well. The first movie is fine. The first movie is like your basic Dragon Ball Z thing, right? You've got a demon child who's cursed by heaven and has to decide between being good and bad and all that stuff. Very basic, like fantasy epic, but it has some good stuff to it. Neja 2 is one of the most beautiful animated films I've ever seen. It is wild. It is like this animation studio basically got so many resources, and the director, it's sort of like, if you think of the jump from like a movie like Willow to like The Lord of the Rings, just in terms of scale and epicness and just like what they're doing, it is wild. I even saw it in 3D. I'm not the biggest 3D fan, but it looked good. It had like, they definitely knew how to deal with 3D layering and all that stuff. So big animated epic. I would recommend seeing Neja 2 in theaters if you can, but you got to see the first one, because this movie, it does not hold, it has a brief intro to recap like what happened, but it will not hold your hand. Characters are getting thrown in there. Stuff just happens. You will not have a sense of this world or the sense of humor or like the scope of what they're doing if you don't see the first movie. And the first movie is only 90 minutes. So I think it's worth watching, even though it's not like the best animated film out there, to get to the second movie, which is fantastic. Truly a tremendous work of cinema. So check out Neja 2. It's in theaters now. You'll be able to stream it at home eventually, but it's sort of like, will you watch Avatar at home? You know, will you watch like a big, large scale epic? Unless you have a really good home theater, there's probably little chance you're going to be doing that. So that's why I'm saying, like, get out to the theater, go see things on a big screen. I'm all about the big screen thing. Like, even though I have like, I'm lucky enough to have a home theater set up with a projector and everything, but I still prefer going to the theater when I can for a lot of these movies. So yeah, check out Neja 2. It's in theaters now. That's it for this episode, folks. Thanks for joining us. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Igor online at...
That's Igor Bonifacic, Bonifacic, at Blue Sky.
Awesome. And you can find me at Blue Sky. I'm at Devendra. I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. Go check out our Neja 2 review or review of all the major movies this year. You can email us at podcastinggadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Thanks, folks. We're out.